Hi, and welcome to the Your Health Podcast from NPR Science Desk. I'm Scott Hensley, Big Cheese for Shots, NPR's health blog, and it's my pleasure this week to welcome a special guest host. It's actually a return for her, health reporter and frequent shots contributor, Julie Rovner. Julie, great to have you here.
Thank you, Scott. It is very nice to be back. We have a fabulous set of stories today on the podcast. We'll hear a report from Melissa Block about young mothers with HIV in Mozambique. And new science reporter Shankar Vandadam will try to get to the bottom of some conflicting studies about the effects of violent video games on kids' brains. And best of all, our colleague Patty Naiman will give us back massages. Well, at least a story about back massages.
We'll also hear from Julie about a new study that is shedding light on the debate over whether having Medicaid is better than having no insurance at all. And we'll chat about a few of our favorite blog posts of the week, which are a motley collection this time around, from summer camp to colonoscopies.
That's quite a collection. But first, video games. Recently, the Supreme Court overturned California's ban on violent video games because the justices weren't convinced that the games really harm kids. But there have been lots of studies looking into the effects of violent video games and other violent media on kids. They just haven't come out with one clear set of conclusions. This got NPR science reporter Shankar Vandadam wondering if maybe the confusion lies in how people are defining harm when it comes to kids' brains and behavior. He waded into the research to find out.
You probably thought you weren't going to die today.
There is strong disagreement among researchers about how much games like Grand Theft Auto and Postal affect young people. The irony is that scientists who think the games are harmful and those who think they're not are both looking at the same evidence. They just see two different things. Most experiments into the effects of violent video games are done with college students. Researchers divide them into two groups. One plays a violent game, the other a non-violent game. Then researchers measure how students in each group feel and how they behave. Now, you can't give young people guns and knives to see whether they'll kill each other after playing a violent video game, so scientists have come up with other ways to measure emotional responses. Social psychologist Brad Bushman decided to show students violent pictures, one of a man shoving a gun down another man's throat, a second of a man holding a knife to a woman's throat.
What we found is for people who were exposed to a lot of violent video games, their brains did not respond to the violent images. They were numb, if you will.
Bushman also had the students blast each other with loud noises.
We tried to make the noise as unpleasant as possible by thinking of every noise you hate. So like fingernails scratching on a chalkboard, dentist drills, sirens.
We're going to keep the volume down, but in the experiment, this is the kind of sound students inflicted on one another. And they could make it as loud as a smoke alarm if they wanted. Some students got really mean.
Everybody was more aggressive if they played a violent game than if they played a nonviolent game. And the more numb they were, the more aggressive they were in terms of blasting their opponent with loud noise through headphones.
That sounds airtight. Bushman believes that violent video games desensitize young people. Compared to people in the real world who are gentle and compassionate, students playing these games are mean and hurtful. And then there's Chris Ferguson, a psychologist at the Texas A&M International University. He's conducted similar experiments and also sees the same behavior changes among students, but he interprets them entirely differently. Ferguson says compared to people in the real world who shoot and stab one another, the changes in behavior he's seen among students are transient and trivial.
Most of the debate now is really onto these kind of minor acts of aggressiveness, which is just thinking negative things about another person. You know, maybe, you know, we're talking about little children essentially sticking their tongues out at each other or that sort of thing.
Ferguson says it's easy to think senseless video game violence can lead to senseless violence in the real world. But that's mixing up two separate things.
Many of the games do have morally objectionable material. And I think that's where a lot of the debate on this issue went off the rails. We kind of mistook our moral concerns about some of these video games, which are very valid. I find many of the games to be morally objectionable. And then assumed that what is morally objectionable is harmful.
In other words, define harm as get in trouble with the police, and violent video games aren't a risk. But if you're worried about lesser kinds of harm, they can be a risk. Here's Brad Bushman again.
Playing violent video games probably will not turn your child into a psychopathic killer. But I would want to know how the child treats his or her parents, how they treat their siblings, how much compassion they have.
And so on. So it turns out that the dueling scientific studies really aren't at odds with each other. They just make different assumptions, which may be why Bushman and Ferguson agree on one thing. As fathers, they've banned their own kids from playing violent video games. Shankar Vedantam, NPR News.
Now, from brains to bucks, money spent on healthcare. Let's hear a radio piece that Julie filed this week about a landmark Medicaid study from Oregon. It's shedding light on what it really means for a person's health to have Medicaid compared to being uninsured.
Anyone who thinks Medicaid provides good insurance just needs to talk to people who have it, says program critic John Goodman. He's president of the Conservative National Center for Policy Analysis.
A Boston cab driver told me the other day that she had to go through 20 doctors before she could find one who would see her. I said, "Are you going down the yellow pages?" She said, "No, I was going down a list that Medicaid gave me."
Scott Gottlieb is a physician who treats Medicaid patients at New York University Hospital. He's also a senior fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute.
What's happening is, I think, Medicaid patients, their health is suffering because the quality of the insurance is being driven down over time.
In a widely quoted column he wrote for the Wall Street Journal this spring, Gottlieb cited a large body of academic work showing Medicaid coverage was lacking.
Studies show there's, you know, a large number of studies now that show poorer outcomes for the Medicaid recipients.
Meaning they're sicker than those with other kinds of insurance. Some critics even say having Medicaid is worse than having no insurance at all. But a new study suggests that Medicaid actually has a dramatic and positive effect on the lives of the people it serves. Amy Finkelstein is an economics professor at MIT in Boston and one of the study's lead investigators.
We found that people who have Medicaid use more health care, have less out-of-pocket medical expenses and medical debt, and report that they are in better health and overall well-being than similar individuals without insurance.
And despite claims that doctors are more likely to accept patients with no insurance than people with Medicaid, that's not what Finkelstein and her colleagues found.
We see that chance that you've gotten any outpatient care increases by 35% if you have Medicaid relative to if you have none. The chance that they report having a regular office or clinic for their primary care increases by 70%. And the likelihood they report having a particular doctor, you know, a usual doctor that they see, increases by 55%.
Now, before you chalk this up to just another case of dueling studies, consider this. The study by Finkelstein and colleagues from Harvard, the National Bureau of Economic Research, and the state of Oregon is the first one of its type in nearly 40 years.
I think it's literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
She's excited because until now, researchers couldn't ethically design a study that denies health insurance to people. But circumstances in Oregon a couple of years ago provided an ethical way to easily compare the health of people who got Medicaid with those who had no insurance. You see, Oregon decided in 2008 that it only had enough money in its budget to allow 10,000 more adults into Medicaid, but tens of thousands more Oregonians were poor and eligible. So the state held a Medicaid lottery. Those who won got to apply. Once they got Medicaid, researchers entered these randomly selected people into their study, along with thousands of adults who lost the lottery and remained uninsured. This kind of randomized controlled study is the gold standard for research, so it would now be possible to answer a question that's been hanging over Medicaid for 40 years. Are people better off on Medicaid, or are they sicker because they have Medicaid?
And certainly in this setting, in Oregon, in our population, there's no evidence that having Medicaid is worse than no insurance. In fact, quite the opposite. It's much better.
Studies that are less rigorous, she says, can produce odd results, leading to claims like those being made by Gottlieb and other Republicans that having insurance or Medicaid makes you sicker, something Finkelstein's study clearly did not find. Julie Rovner, NPR News.
Julie, I had a question. What's next for the people who participated in this study?
Well, now they're going to go even deeper. Until now, they've been doing interviews mostly by mail and by phone. Now the researchers are actually going to do personal interviews with 12,000 of the people included in this study, including performing medical tests. They're going to do blood pressure checks. They're going to do blood draws to check for cholesterol, to really get actual, you know, on-the-ground comparisons of what it means to have Medicaid compared to what it means to be uninsured. This will give us a really definitive picture of a comparison that they've really never been able to do before.
How long will all that take?
It could take a couple of years. Remember, this is just the first year of this study. It's going to be ongoing for quite a while.
Now, this study, and it's called the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, kind of echoes the famous Rand Health Insurance Experiment back in the 70s, famous at least to people who care about healthcare as much as Julie. So can you fill us in? Is this kind of randomized study really so unusual?
It is. Actually, this study is unique. The Rand Health Insurance Experiment, which was done in the 1970s, in fact gave everyone insurance because it would be unethical to create a study in which everyone didn't benefit somewhat. So in this study, obviously not everyone benefited. In fact, there were 90,000 people who applied for Medicaid in Oregon. Only 10,000 people got to apply for Medicaid. That would have been unethical if it was set up as a research experiment. Of course, it wasn't set up as a research experiment. It was set up because that's all the money that Oregon had.
The government policy.
That was all the money Oregon had to allow that many more people onto Medicaid. It was only after the fact that the researchers found out about it and that the state was willing to participate in this unique research experiment. This really is the first of its kind to be able to compare, as they say, in a randomized controlled trial. So no one has ever been able to do this before, including the Rand Health Insurance Experiment.
Well, it sounds like the folks in Oregon, the researchers, are making the most of it. So it'll be interesting to track how it comes out.
This has the potential to go on the way, you know, the Framingham Heart Study has gone on that's followed, you know, these nurses, you know, for however many, 20-some years now.
Yeah.
I think there's an anticipation that they want to follow these people in an ongoing way for many years because this is really a unique set of circumstances.
Can't wait for your updates on the progress.
Moving on. One of the preventive measures that will be provided under the new health insurance law is colonoscopies. This week on NPR's health blog, Richard Knox wrote about a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that showed that more Americans than ever are being screened for colorectal cancer. I'll leave it to Scott to spell out what that involves.
Well, let's see. There are three tests we could talk about. First, there's the test for blood in the stool, which authorities recommend getting every year. Then there's the lower colon exam every 5 years, which is like colonoscopy light. And then the full-on colonoscopy every 10 years.
That's the one that everybody loves. Well, the good news is that the CDC report shows that these preventive measures really do work. They estimate that screening prevented 16,000 deaths from colorectal cancer between 2003 and 2007.
Less than half of those people back in the 90s would have been up to date. Now, the issue is there's still a third of people who have not gotten their colonoscopies or other tests to check for the early stages or precursors of colorectal cancer. And that was the focus of Richard's post. That's the real key to all of this, is colorectal cancer is one of those cancers where if you catch it in time, the prevention rate, the success rate in keeping it from becoming a problem is very high. And so the CDC is making a big push to make sure that the people who should get screened for colorectal cancer are getting screened for colorectal cancer in time.
And how are they going to do that? It's obviously, you know, that last group that's going to be the hardest to reach. That first group is obviously doing it, so they're pretty well motivated.
Publicity. Dr. Thomas Frieden, who's the head of the CDC, in announcing the results, also described his own experience getting a colonoscopy, which found some polyps that were removed. Frieden, I think, in giving his own experience, was trying to revive this Couric effect, this Katie Couric effect from a few years back, where she really helped improve the screening rates by talking about her own family's history. Her husband had died from colorectal cancer, and then taking the rather extreme step of having her own colonoscopy televised.
And how many Katie Couric's really are there?
She's unique. But I think the notion that by bringing this into the public's consciousness as often as possible and in different ways may help reach this group of people that hasn't yet been screened.
Do they think that, you know, the idea that there may not be the cost barriers will help reach this group? Or is it just, I mean, there are some people that don't want to take the time to get preventive care regardless. And then there's the people who think, well, I can't afford it.
In fact, they looked at that, and one of the other barriers that they're trying to work on is making sure that doctors tell patients, you should do this, because it turns out that's one of the big reasons, even if people have the coverage, that they don't think about doing it, is because the doctor didn't tell them to.
And finally, I want to talk with you about a piece you wrote for the blog this week, Scott, in which the state of Maryland enacted some fairly strict new restrictions regarding putting sunscreen on kids at camp and then seemed to change its mind. I get the sense that the inspiration from this story came from home, right?
It did a little bit. I have campers in my house, and I think as parents with young kids will attest, it's often difficult to get sunscreen on them, even when you know you should. And the issue that came up in Maryland was a rule that was really trying to find a balance on protection against skin cancer with sunscreen and protection against inappropriate touching. And the upshot of it was that this regulation to camps came down that said parents had to authorize, just like it was a prescription drug, the use of this stuff, and it discouraged the camps from providing sunscreen, and it prohibited, for instance, campers helping one another apply the sunscreen if that involved touching. So it really kind of went overboard, and after this got some attention from the Washington Post, the state of Maryland quickly reversed course.
So what is the status of the sunscreen regulation now? Who can put sunscreen on campers?
Parents still have to authorize their kids to get sunscreen. Camps can help them, but it is really encouraged that the parents buy the kind of sunscreen that the kid can put on his or herself. They dialed it back a little. There's still permission required, but I think the balance shifted more towards protection against sun exposure, which is, you know, the number one carcinogen for young kids, versus worries about the inappropriate touching.
As a parent, I would guess that you would lean more towards that you want your kids with the sunscreen on, don't you?
Yeah, of course you're concerned that nothing bad should happen to them, but as somebody who looks at the statistics on skin cancer, I would probably worry about that a little bit more.
I have to say my horse has a white nose and is out 18 hours a day, and there is sunscreen hanging on his stall, and sometimes I get annoyed because they don't put it on.
Did you have to sign a form?
I did not have to sign a form, but I keep putting the notes on, please remember to put the sunscreen on his nose before he goes out, because he gets quite sunburned, and it looks quite painful.
I bet.
While we may be on the colonoscopy beat here on the podcast, this week reporter Patty Naiman got the chance to investigate a much more appealing side of medicine, massage therapy. She reports on a new study that shows that getting a massage doesn't just feel good, it can also be an effective treatment for chronic lower back pain.
Peggy O'Brien Murphy tried just about everything to get rid of the pain in her lower back. What really worked was something that she got in a quiet, peaceful room with massage therapist Loretta Lawns.
Right now, I'm going to be adjusting your hips by doing a pull from the ankles. How does that feel?
Feels good.
Lawns wants to know if her patient's hips, legs, or back muscles are tight. She places one hand on the hip, the other on the back, and then begins to gently rock O'Brien Murphy back and forth.
This motion is part of a relaxation motion, jostling and rocking. And at the same time, I'm also using my fingertips to see what muscles may be tight.
O'Brien Murphy's in her late 60s, a retired state employee whose back pain was so severe at one point she could hardly get out of a chair.
It was really bad. In fact, I was pulling myself up the stairs by the banister.
It was difficult getting into the car, and she could no longer walk the hills where she lives. So when she came upon an ad in her HMO's newsletter, Group Health Cooperative in Seattle, she jumped at the chance to take part in a massage study. Her sessions with therapist Lawns made her feel better right away.
When I would leave her office, I just felt like I could stand straighter. The hip didn't hurt as much, and I could move more easily, and it felt good.
And it was the same story for many of the people who took part in the study. Epidemiologist Daniel Churkin divided participants into three groups: full-body relaxation massage, targeted deep tissue massage, or medication and physical therapy. After 10 weeks, results were dramatic. Two-thirds of the patients in the massage groups said their back pain significantly improved or went away altogether, compared to only one-third of patients in the group that used medication. Churkin says massage relieved the pain for 6 months or more.
We found that both types of massage were equally effective in helping people improve their function and diminish their symptoms.
Dr. Richard Dio of Oregon Health Sciences University says no one knows exactly how massage works to relieve pain.
It may be that it helps with relaxation of muscles that are tense, but it may also be that there are simply more generalized effects of relaxation and a caring and attention and someone laying hands on that may all be important.
For O'Brien Murphy, the experience was life-changing.
Oh, I've got a spring to my walk and some energy in it. You bet. I've been to China and we walked all over and, oh, I am so lucky.
But now, O'Brien Murphy works hard to prevent a recurrence. Other studies have shown that building strong and flexible muscles can help prevent back pain. O'Brien Murphy never exercised before, but now she does weight training, muscle stretches, and aerobic exercise. Patty Namond, NPR News.
This summer, NPR unrolled a special series called Beginnings, Pregnancy, Childbirth, and Beyond. All Things Considered host Melissa Block traveled to Mozambique to explore what life transitions mean to the people in that southern African country. Last week on the podcast, we heard a report she sent back about medication used to decrease the incidence of women dying in childbirth. This week, she tells a story about efforts to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV.
I've come to the hot zone for HIV infection in Mozambique, Gaza province, where 25% of those aged 15 to 49 are HIV positive. Among women in Gaza, that number is even higher. 30% are infected with HIV. At this health clinic in the town of Masia, 24-year-old Adelia is about to get an HIV test. She's wearing a stylish gray suit with a shiny alligator print handbag. Adelia is about 5 months pregnant. And if you come here for prenatal care, as she has, you will get tested for HIV. Nurse Celestina Matavel rips open the test kit, making sure the young woman notices it's a new kit just for her, so there's no danger of contamination. A finger prick, a drop of blood on the narrow test strip, and a short, anxious wait. The nurse and patient bow their heads closer to the strip as two faint red stripes emerge. Positive, Adelia murmurs. A second test confirms the result. She is HIV positive, with a baby due in the fall. She presses her lips together and gets a faraway look as the nurse urges, "Don't be scared.
Relax. HIV doesn't mean you're dead. Don't dare lose strength. You'll live your life the same way. When you get malaria, don't you come to the hospital? Don't you take medication? Don't you live? It's the same as this. Don't think your life is going to change."
That's an American doctor, Nancy Fitch, telling Adelia, if you take your medication, your baby will be okay.
Há esperança, muito esperança para você e também a sua criança.
I have a lot of hope for you and your child, Fitch tells Adelia. You can have a normal life, and your child can too.
Courage.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Fitch has brought us to this clinic. She's country director for the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation in Mozambique, which helps fund the work here. Adelia will be put on antiretroviral drugs through the last months of her pregnancy and through breastfeeding, so she doesn't pass HIV on to her baby. The newborn will also be given the drugs. Adelia will be advised to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months, something that's not part of the protocol in the West. But in developing countries, it's believed that the benefits outweigh the risks. If Adelia can stay with the regimen, the chance of her baby being infected can be reduced to about 5%, down from 30 to 40% if she were to do nothing. Outside, Dr. Fitch looks around at the hundreds of women waiting patiently, many of them HIV positive, with HIV positive children.
Here you're probably in one of the places where one is most inclined to feel overwhelmed.
She says the AIDS epidemic has reversed the steady progress Mozambique had made in reducing the mortality of children.
In the last 10 years in Gaza, the impact of this epidemic has just been terrible. So here in Gaza, you're at a place where you really feel it's in your face. Yeah.
And Dr. Fitch knows the women here are confronting harsh realities.
Babies in the past, if you had an HIV-positive baby, they would just... It's easier to let the baby die rather than take on a commitment to feed an extra mouth and make all these trips to the doctors and stand in line one day a month waiting for medication. It's a burden that a family on the edge could probably not afford.
Do you think that's still the case?
Absolutely. Not everywhere, and there's definitely progress being made. But on a day-to-day level, when you come here and you see the effort that needs to be made, it seems really hard sometimes.
Nearly all of the money to run this clinic for the drugs and test kits comes from international donors, the Global Fund set up to fight AIDS, and the U.S. government's fund called PEPFAR. In fiscal year 2010, PEPFAR's budget for Mozambique totaled nearly $270 million. That's more than what Mozambique contributes to its entire healthcare system. Even with all of this outside aid, about a third of pregnant women in Mozambique known to have HIV aren't getting the drugs to prevent transmission. Lucrencia Silva has brought her 15-month-old daughter Elena into the clinic. Elena wears a tiny soccer sweatshirt over her turquoise tulle dress. Both mother and daughter are HIV positive.
Mama,
Lucrencia is picking up a month's supply of free antiretroviral drugs for her baby. The drugs will slow the progression of the disease. Without treatment, half of all infants infected with HIV will die by their second birthday. If Lucrencia can't find a ride to the clinic, she'll walk 2 hours each way.
Tell me about your hopes for Elena here.
She tells me, I want her to lead a good life, to be healthy, and I want to live a long life. Lucrencia's story is one I heard over and over, and it illustrates just how the virus spreads. Many men in Gaza province, like Lucrencia's husband, go to South Africa to work in the mines. They're away for long stretches. Prostitution is rampant, and so is HIV. They bring the virus home to their wives. A Sunday morning service at a Presbyterian church in the village of Malais. It's a small square structure made out of thatch with sunlight filtering through. The women and children sway as they sing. Except for the pastor, there are no men here. They're either working in South Africa or just don't come. I meet one of the pastor's daughters, Akasia Navete Mukambi. She's slim and delicate with a radiant smile. Her 16-month-old daughter, Virginia, dozes through the service in a sling on her mom's back. Akasia also has an 8-year-old son, Muyanga, who's so tiny, he looks about half that age. Akasia's husband works in the mines in South Africa. She tells me he got very sick and tested positive for HIV in 2007.
Akasia, how do you think your husband got HIV?
I don't know where he got it. Now so many people have the disease. So I didn't give him a hard time about it. It's possible that he got it from me, but he went to get tested first. So that's why I didn't give him a hard time about it.
Acacia's husband urged her to get tested, but she waited. She was scared and worried she'd be shunned. She got very sick and terribly thin. It wasn't until she was pregnant with Virginia that she finally had the HIV test. It was positive. Now, with drugs that fight HIV, her health has improved. She's gained some weight, and her daughter, Virginia, has tested negative. But Acacia faces a problem that's common in Mozambique. Because of drug shortages or stockouts, sometimes she can only get 1 week's supply of pills, not the whole month's worth. This is a big problem in rural areas like this one, where just getting to a clinic to pick up the drugs can take hours, by foot or bike. If you make people come back more often to get their drugs, chances are they'll fall off the regimen and they'll get sick. As her children, Muyanga and Virginia, play nearby, Acacia talks about her fears for their future.
Since I have HIV, I'm scared of dying and leaving my children while they're still very young. But if the medicines really work, I'm not going to die of HIV. I'm going to die of everyday illnesses.
After church, Acacia and the other parishioners gather in a circle outside, and her face lights up as she sings these words, "Praying is what gives you hope. I will not go back. I must go forward."
Well, that's all for the Your Health podcast this week. If you can't wait for more health news, join us on Shots at npr.org/shots. And Julie, I have to say it was a pleasure to have you here with us today. Come back as soon as you can.
Well, I will, but really, I thought I was going to get a back massage.
I'll have to send a form to the state of Maryland first.